Ladies and gentlemen, I think it's time that we began, if I may have your attention. It's a very great honor for me to have been invited to chair this fifth and last lecture, Sumitomo lecture here in LSE. I've had the privilege of being associated with this series right from the beginning, and I know that I've always got a great deal of enjoyment and benefit out of them. And I think we can be particularly pleased this evening to have as our speaker in the last of this series Professor Kitaoka, who is Professor of Political Science, Modern Japanese Politics and Diplomacy at Rikkyo University. Professor Kitaoka did his studies at the University of Tokyo, but has his professional career since then has been always in Rikkyo University, with a short escape to Princeton for a couple of years. I tried very hard to press Professor Kitaoka before we started this meeting to say exactly what it was that he was going to talk to us about. And very intelligently, he refused to be pinned down on that. So we can expect anything from him. But it will be around the subject, which I think is not only a fascinating, but also a very topical one, of Japan's foreign policy between Asia and the United States. And I would say especially, given the situation with China at the moment, this could be a very topical evening indeed. I have to say, Professor Kitaoka, that I spent most of my career in the Commission trying to say that Japan was not between Asia and anywhere. Japan was part of Asia. But perhaps Professor Kitaoka will tell us why that was a wrong approach. Professor Kitaoka, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Simon Nata. For a very kind introduction. It's a really great pleasure and honor for me to be here, and it's particularly a pleasure for me to be here to make a kind of review of Japan's foreign policy. What I'd like to do is the kind of review of Japan's foreign policy from historical and geographical viewpoint. I'm not trying to defend Japan's foreign policy at all. That's very far from my intention. Nor I'm not trying to criticize the foreign policies of other countries, our neighboring countries. That's again very far from my intention. Rather, I'd like to just evaluate the state of international relations around Japan. And I'd like to show to which direction Japan should go. Actually, I was thinking of making a kind of apology because my paper, the original thing on which this paper is based, I wrote that part of paper about 3 years ago. So I was afraid that might be a little bit out of date, but coincidentally, the situation around Taiwan is coming closer to my paper. Not I'm coming back, going to the Taiwan case. One thing I'd like to add before beginning my talk is that when I began my study in the Graduate School of Tokyo University, more than 20 years ago, one of my first assignments was a book written by Professor Nish, who is over there. That book was named Alliance in Decline. Of course, the Anglo-Japanese Alliance at that time. Now, my focus today is a possible decline of another alliance, the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty. Well, let me begin my talk with referring to the first Japanese Blue Book, which was published by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in 1957, in which they made it public that Japan will stick to the three principles. There are three principles for Japan diplomacy. It was the year after 1956. In 1956, Japan restored the relations with the Soviet Russia in October, and in December Japan was accepted to the United Nations. And after that, it was a very good occasion for Japan to make a thorough review of Japan's foreign policy. And they made public that Japan would stick to the three principles. Number one, the UN-centered diplomacy. Number two, strengthening Japan's status as a member of Asian countries. And number three, cooperation, close cooperation with the West. That means liberal democracies. The order, in this order, this is very interesting. Number one, United Nations. Number two, Asia. And number three, the West. Cooperation with the West. But actually, as everyone knows, Japan did not follow the principles very faithfully. Just imagine what were the major events in Japanese diplomatic history since then. The revision of the US-Japan Security Treaty in 1960, the return of Okinawa to Japan in 1972, and most of other important events, diplomatic events, are with the United States or closely related to the United States. Other two principles that were given higher priorities than the cooperation with the West were not given enough focus. The UN-centered diplomacy did not exist, actually. The Japan's active Asian policy did not, actually, strictly speaking, exist before the end of the Cold War. I do not mean that it was wrong for Japan not to pursue the pro-Asian, pro-UN approach before pro-US approach. Because the at that time, the possibility of an armed conflict between the United States and Soviet Russia was the biggest concern to the world. So it was very natural for Japan to have paid more attention to that, to prepare for that. It was natural and acceptable approach. But after the Cold War, of course, the things have to change. I'm not saying that the authors of the so-called three principles in 1957 were wrong. They were by instinct. They could catch the most important parts of Japan's diplomacy. But by this kind of conflict between the United States and Soviet Russia, the two other principles just evaded from our sight. Now that the Cold War is over, Japan should eventually review its diplomatic stance. And it was quite natural for Japan, Japanese people, Japanese government to look to Asia as well as to the United Nations. That's what taking place since the end of the Cold War. In 1990, because of the Gulf War, many Japanese people looked to the United Nations, what Japan should do within the framework of the United Nations. And then pro-Asian sentiment emerged very remarkably. Though, actually, this is one of the most important, remarkable developments since the end of the Cold War, I think, the pro-Asian sentiment. It was quite natural for Japan to look to Asia because the economic ties with those Asian countries had become very close. Particularly since 1985, it was a year when a drastic appreciation of yen began after the so-called Plaza Agreement in September 1985, because I remember that very well, because there was an international conference which I organized 2 months before the Plaza Agreement. At that time, we were in short of money, but after that, suddenly yen began to rise. But anyhow, I thought that could have happened before, half a year earlier. Anyhow, the focus on Asia is a natural adaptation to the economic reality. And also, I find that many of my students, younger generation, is now finding or rediscovering Asia as a very interesting place. They make trips. It's a custom for Japanese students. Just immediately before graduation, they make a lot of foreign trips, including London. You can find many shoppers in London also. But many of them, more and more people are now going to Southeast Asia, Asia, Australia, and that region. Anyhow, the feeling is this. The Asia-Pacific region is becoming more and more familiar place for us. That's quite natural and healthy development for Japan. But I do like to say that there are a few points we have to be very careful about. One is that through the history of modern Japan, the pro-Asian sentiment have developed when our relations with the West became bad. For example, please allow me to make a rather sudden coming back to the history, because I'm a historian originally. So the 19th century or even 17th century are very familiar to me. But this kind of jump is allowed in the United Kingdom, I guess. In 1880s, it was one of the age when the pro-Asian sentiment emerged, just because of Japan's difficulty with treaty revision. Japan tried to revise its unequal treaties with the West unsuccessfully. That caused much rise of pan-Asian sentiment. Another example is 1933, when Japan went out of the League of Nations. At that time, there was a small Japanese community in Geneva, probably smaller than in London. Among them, there prevailed a kind of sentiment, let's come back to Asia. We are tired of communicating with the West. So this kind of pro-Asian sentiment was sometimes a reflection of the difficulty Japan had with the West. If today's pro-Asian sentiment is just a reflection of the difficulty which we are having with the West, then it cannot be a sound basis for healthy diplomacy. But I'm a little bit concerned, because when the so-called Kenbei, or hatred against the United States, Kenbei sentiment appeared, it was just immediately, it was paralleled with the rise of pan-Asian sentiment and Kenbei sentiment. So this is one of the points we have to be careful about. The second point is that the Asia is too big for us to identify ourselves. What is Asia? Asia is a place east of Europe, probably. While Europe is one civilization based on Greco-Roman heritage and Christianity, Asia contains several civilizations, at least Chinese civilization, Indian civilization, Persian, Islamic, and so forth. So I really think that when Japanese people say we are Asians, that doesn't mean anything. That just means we are not Americans or Europeans. That doesn't make much sense. The concept of Asia is not enough for us to identify ourselves. But actually, frankly speaking, the place we are familiar with, what we can feel familiar with, is East Asia. When it comes to India, for example, India is without doubt the center of Asia, but the Indian civilization is very far from us, despite of the Buddhism tradition. So when we discussed the concept of Asia in the panel, which was set up by Prime Minister Miyazawa in 1992, the first thing was the geographical definition of Asia was the first agenda we tackled too. Anyhow, the place we are familiar with, the East Asia, but again, East Asia is too big a concept for us to identify ourselves. What I'd like to introduce is the theory which was provided by a very famous scholar, Professor Umesao Tadao, who is an anthropologist. Professor Umesao Tadao published his famous article in 1956, 文明の生態史観, or Ecological View of Civilizations. I have been very much impressed by and influenced by that theory, Professor Umesao's theory. I'd like to summarize it very shortly. According to Umesao, the main differences between Japan and other parts of the world is not between East and West. The people used to compare Japan with the West, East and West. But actually, according to him, the eastern edge of Eurasian continent had much similarity with the western edge of Eurasian continent. The coastal areas are rather similar each other compared to the mainland of Eurasian continent. That's his main point. In the coastal area, what you can find? Trade, feudalism, and these make, when trade developed, it can make society more plural. In other words, the trade can limit the authority and the power of the central government. As a result, there emerges countries, the states, which have rather small and weak governments with rather free civil societies. And also the trade brings states together by fostering mutual interests from country to country. At that time, Professor Umesao just tried to compare Japan with Western Europe. But nowadays, I feel, and also this is what Professor Umesao is saying recently, that the ASEAN countries, Southeast Asian countries are now joining the ranks of this trading states. Very different type you can find in the mainland, inner part of the continent. Within the Eurasian continent, we can find Russian Empire, Indian Empire, Chinese Empire, so huge empires. Empires with despotic powers on the top and no freedom on the level of people, very little limited freedom. In China, the Chinese emperor was the man who could control the rivers and the mountains under the mandate of heaven. And feudal aristocrats disappeared. Feudalism disappeared many, many centuries ago. And there was no freedom of religion, no rise of bourgeoisies, no rule of law that could limit the power of the emperor effectively. In that sense, in the Chinese history, the central theme was always the power, central power, and the struggles for power. The power struggles dominated everything in China throughout the Chinese history. And I have to add one more thing. There did not emerge any international system in which nations are equal, theoretically. Theoretically, in the international relations, the sovereign states are equal, theoretically, not substantially. But in China, China occupies the biggest and the central place always, and the other states are considered to be inferior culturally, in terms of power, and in many ways. Those other countries are considered to be the barbarians who should follow the teachings of Chinese civilization. As a result, these nations surrounding China became the objects for manipulation rather than equal partners or rivals. That is ironically why China failed to counter the Western threat in 19th century, because Chinese people considered them as barbarians who could be manipulated. Actually, they were too strong to be manipulated. On the other hand, in the Japanese case, Japan was on the periphery of Chinese civilization, Japanese people knew that there was something which was stronger and more superior to Japanese, to the Japanese people and Japanese civilization. That's why they could rather effectively counter with the Western threat. Now let me go to the a little bit prediction about China, the evaluation of China, the state of politics in China, and some kind of prediction for the future. It seems to me that China is still clinging to the diplomacy of power. China believes in China, in power. And also, what's important is China does not pay much respect for the concept of interdependence, mutual cooperation. These are based on the old history, historical heritage, partly. Say, for example, their policy toward the Spratly Islands in the past 3-4 years, and also the contemporary policy toward Taiwan. They believe in power, and finally the solution should be decided by power. It's a kind of concept. Also, Chinese diplomacy has not really accepted the concept of international cooperation. It was remarkable for me that when Japan tried to mine sweepers to the Gulf area in 1990, China objected to the deployment of Japanese military units overseas, but finally accepted or became silent, dropped its objection, saying that the Gulf area is very important to Japan. So China could understand why Japan wanted to make it stable. And the Japanese sending minesweepers to that region is understandable. That was their reason of acquiescence. But it's a kind of a dangerous theory that powers can send their military troops to the places where they have much vested interests. What's important today is a kind of international cooperation among powers based on the... I'd like to stress this because today's military technology, actually I myself wrote a dissertation. My first dissertation was about Japanese military, and the technological development had much impact on politics, and also the inability to accept the development of military technology can cause a very big mistake. That's what happened in Japan. Anyhow, one of the characteristics of today's security is that the military technology's development, it's enormous destructive power is available to the countries which is not rich at all. Even North Korea, even Iraq could build up such an awful military. Even a small religious group in Japan could get a kind of dangerous thing. It was a rather unexpected thing which took place last year. On the other hand, today's major powers, which are rich and free, are rather reluctant in engaging any military activities. They are very much reluctant. As a result, it's very difficult to suppress the challengers. What's the solution? The only answer is that we have to make a close, fair cooperation. Otherwise, it's very difficult to suppress the challenges to the world order and to maintain the order and peace. In that sense, Chinese belief in power politics, Chinese disregard for international cooperation are some of the things I'm afraid of. It's understandable because China had long sought to protect itself against the imperial encroachment. China had to rely on their own power. China was not given any substantial help other than Soviet Russia in a certain period. So they had to rely on their own power, but it's still a dangerous idea to rely on solely on their power. Do you remember the reasons why China continued the nuclear test last year? They said that one, it is the right of self-defense. And if the nuclear development is allowed based on the theory of right of self-defense, then any country can make it. That would invite a very dangerous situation, needless to say. But anyhow, nowadays, Chinese economic development is a marvelous success. I am a great admirer of the Chinese economic development in the past 10 years. But now China is in a difficult stage. China is coming to a very difficult stage, I think. Everyone says the difficulty of inflation and income gap and corruption and so forth. Not only these things, but also the relationship between the politics and the economy is coming to a very difficult point. Chinese people are genius of economic activities. No one doubts it. For centuries, Chinese people are genius of economic activities. But why China? The right question should be not why China developed. The right question should be why China could not develop until recently. My answer is China did not have enough political basis, reliable political basis on which a healthy economic activity was done. The tendency was that politics intervene into economic activities and exploit the fruits of economic activities. Let me remember one or two examples in the past. In the 1920s, there was a warlord, Chan Tsorin, in Manchuria, which had much support from Japan. But what he did to the people of Manchuria was that Manchurian economy was much based on the soybeans and wheat. When the season comes, he just printed money to get soybeans and wheat. Of course, he can get money. He can make much money. After that, inflation, high inflation. He needed that money very much to make his influence in Beijing, to have more influence in Beijing, to have more military. That kind of intervention and exploitation by politics to economy is very common in China. The reliable political basis is finally provided by the Chinese Communist Party. That's what I admire. But communist regime is communist regime. I do not believe that people will be silent without political freedom when they have become rich. When they become richer and richer, then they definitely need more freedom. And that would make much conflict with the political system, political regime. As a result, I am rather certain that a time of political instability will come to China, or that has come already. Not only after Mr. Deng Xiaoping, there should be a bitter conflict over the power. And as I have stressed, the political power struggle is very important in China. That is done at all costs. They compete each other. In that case, when the leaders compete each other, when there is no stable power in the center of Chinese politics, no one can make a soft policy. The tough policy is likely to emerge. Just look at the Soviet Russia or Russia. When Gorbachev or Yeltsin was strong, they could show some conciliatory approach to Japan over the northern territories, but it was now gone. When the leaders were weak in their political basis, then they cannot make any concession. Otherwise, they could be called betrayers to the fatherland. So the competition will emerge, or emerging already. As a result, the tougher diplomacy will emerge. That's what's probably happening in China over Taiwan. Some people say that the Chinese ambition, the danger of Chinese modernization of military effort, things like that. But to me, it seems to me that that kind of modernization effort is not a result of ambition. Rather, it is a result of the weakening central power. They are becoming unable to control the bureaucracy, military bureaucracy and other bureaucracies. I'm not all pessimistic. I have some good points. I can find some good points in China. When I meet Chinese scholars, when I meet Chinese politicians, in the younger generation, there are more people who believe in the international cooperation, who do not believe in power politics. There's a kind of more enlightened generation coming up. That's what I hope, and that's what I find. But still, China is facing a difficulty now. Those younger generation has not reached to the top or the center of the power. Some people say that China will become big, and then China will become danger. I rather predict in a different way. China may not become a big power. If China becomes a very big power, then that means a very good customer to Japanese economy. And if China has become a really rich country, then probably the politics will be more liberated one, and that will mean a more reliable partner in Asia. But if there comes a breakdown in economy, there will emerge more competition, power politics, political power games among leaders. That would cause, that would invite a resurgence of nationalism. On the other hand, let me look at Southeast Asia. In the South, again, there's another miracle in Southeast Asia. It's really remarkable when we look back Southeast Asia. When the ASEAN was formed in 1967, it was just a symbol. It was just a symbol rather than a reality. Without any executive bureau at that time. When first executive bureau was set up in 1974, still it was just a symbol. After the end of Vietnam War, there has been economic development which has continued for rather 15 years. The economic success changed that region rather completely. There were many weak points in ASEAN countries, but actually there has been similarities with Japan. They are just, you can compare the number of military, number of soldiers against the people. Then they have a very low ratio. Military is not particularly strong. Military is not dominating the country. They rely much on trade. The cooperation is going on among them very on a very healthy basis. I just remember that there was a strong criticism from this region when Japan tried to do something when the Gulf crisis took place in 1990, when Japan tried to send some part of Japan's self-defense force to the Gulf area, there was a criticism, strong criticism from, say, Mr. Lee Kuan Yew. But he himself changed his position. At the very beginning, he said that it was like giving some alcohol to the alcoholic to allow Japan to go to Gulf area. But after that, he changed his position and said that it's okay for Japan to become a part of peacekeeping operations. But he hoped that not to become the teeth or nails of the PKO, just become the whatever, tail or foot or I don't know. The younger generation is more, does not have much kind of opposition of this kind. Now, I believe that there are 16 peacekeeping operations under the United Nations. And now Malaysia, for example, has sent to 15 of them, 15 out of 16. And also Malaysia has sent 3,000 soldiers to the former Bosnia area. So they are just carrying a bigger load than Japan is doing. They just went farther than Japan. I was struck by two developments that took place last year. One, they announced the plans for the Southeast Asia Nuclear Weapon Free Zone, SANWFZ, which is too hard to remember. Anyway, they wanted to establish a nuclear weapon free zone, which has some difficulties with the other nuclear powers, but that can be a very good concept for those middle-sized countries. One of the other things which struck me was a security agreement between Australia and Indonesia. Formerly they were enemies, but nowadays they make a joint exercise in Navy. It developed to the point of a mutual agreement on security. This is not a very strong agreement, but it has a treaty status, and frank consultation is the substantial content of this treaty. But still, it is important. This is the evidence of the their grouping. There is emerging a group of middle-sized non-nuclear powers in Southeast Asia, including Australia, Vietnam, and other Indochina countries, which are soon to join to that ASEAN within a few years. Now, with the development of these Southeast Asian countries, the time has come to give serious considerations to convening CSCE or CSCEA, an Asian version of Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe. Actually, ARF, ASEAN Regional Forum, has been already set up. It was in 94, 2 years ago. But of course, there are some differences between these two. First of all, the starting point, the essence of the CSCE, the starting point of CSCE was the respect for the status quo in terms of territory, borders. But it's very hard to do in Asia because of China-Taiwan problem. China has never given up any right to liberate Taiwan by their own force. That was what I was trying to say, predict, but I didn't have to predict it because now they are doing that. So when we look to the future of Asia, East Asia, and when we think about the regional organization, there are several possibilities, or actually four possibilities. The organization with China in, America in. And the second is with China in, America out. The third is both out, both in. Anyway, four categories are conceivable. If China is in, America is out. That's the worst scenario for us Japanese, because China has the 2/3 of the population of East Asia, which is likely to be dominated by China. It's like an ancient East Asia, map of ancient East Asia. In the center of East Asia, China, and around them, the satellite countries. But anyhow, the other possibility is the regional organization with the United States in, China out. This was somewhat similar to the map in the Cold War era. One possibility is just the coastal area countries without China or the United States, or both in. Now the crucial point, what's the key point is, of course, as a result, the presence of the United States. Whether or not the United States will remain here as a major military power or not. Well, everyone may remember that the so-called Nye Report. Joseph Nye, who is known to us as a professor more than a bureaucrat. Anyhow, Mr. Nye, a team led by Mr. Nye presented a report which was accepted by the president last February, just 1 year ago, in which he said the United States should keep the present level military presence in Asia for the conceivable future. Some specialists, military specialists, say that everything settled with this Nye's idea. I didn't think so at that time. I thought Mr. Nye's plan had some weaknesses, which is now really revealing, I'm afraid. One thing is this. Certainly, having American military in Japan is very cheap. But having stationing American military in Philippines or Guam or even in San Diego will cost more than stationing it in Japan because of Japan's very generous so-called host nation support, which covers almost 70% of the cost which is necessary. But people may think, American people may think that, why do we have to have such a big military? Why not make it small? This kind of idea is emerging, has a rather covert support among the people. The second thing is that, as everyone knows, again, I just have to add that there was an argument between Mr. Nye and Mr. Professor Chalmers Johnson on foreign affairs. July-August issue just carried the article written by Mr. Nye on one hand, and on the other hand, written by Professor Johnson and his associate, in which Professor Johnson argued that Japan was getting more interest, getting much more profit from the alliance. And it's very unfair, the relationship. That's his point. Yes, that's very true, probably. And people are likely to decide their behaviors by not by absolute gains, but by relative gains. If you are given, say, £100, but your friend is getting £300, then you may feel very sad, though you are getting £100. That's what's happening in US-Japan relations. Certainly, the United States is getting some profit, important profit from the US-Japan Security Treaty, but Japan is getting more. That's what Professor Johnson argues. That's probably true, because the relationship between Japan and the United States was decided in 1960, basically. At that time, the United States was super rich and Japan was just a mediocre country. Now, according to Johnson's argument, it's very hard for the US soldiers to eat even Japanese soup, Japanese noodle, outside of the base. That's probably true. So there are a few weak points in the argument of Mr. Nai. When I was thinking that way, there came the case of Okinawa. There was a tragic rape case in Okinawa, which was not very well handled by the Japanese government, and it's now becoming a very big issue. Both leaders, Japanese leaders and American leaders, have almost agreed to reduce the bases in Okinawa. But I'm afraid it would be rather difficult to find out a substitute in other part of Japan. If so, the US bases in Japan will become smaller. That's kind of inevitable. Well, I think the Okinawa people should be freed from that kind of too big burden. Okinawa has been suffered so much. The 70% or 80% of American bases are just concentrated into Okinawa in a very narrow, small islands. So other part of Japan should bear more responsibility for that. But again, it would be not very easy to persuade the people. The bases are not very enjoyable things to have within the neighborhood. So in that sense, the making Okinawa bases is inevitable, I guess. Making Okinawa bases smaller is inevitable. And making the fewer bases, having fewer bases in Japan as a whole, is again probably inevitable. Does it mean a weakened alliance? We have to do that. It would not mean a weakened security treaty. What's important is my argument is that we should make the US-Japan security broadened, widened, and deepened rather than weakening it. Just look at the US-Japan Security Treaty. It has many important clauses which are already almost forgotten. For example, the in the Article 2, the US-Japan Security is not to defend Japan alone. It is decided, it is written in that the American military is allowed to use Japanese bases to contribute to the peace and the security in East Asia, in the Far East. That means the Korean Peninsula and Taiwan Straits. These are the most important parts in the 1950s and 90s, mainly in the 1950s when the security treaty was revised. It was in 1960. It is now 35 years from that time. Japan has become much bigger, much richer, and the military technology has developed very much on the US side and also on the Japanese side. Why not widen it to cover the whole East Asia? For Japan to play bigger role to support the US activities. That's what I mean, widening of US-Japan Security Treaty. On the other hand, the deepening. The US-Japan Security Treaty has been a very important tool against Soviet Russia, particularly in the 80s, since the end of 1970s. So it is just a directed It is just a preparation against a possible Soviet threat. In other words, Japan or the United States are not prepared for other threats very well. For example, the AXA, which I wrote in here, the agreement about the acquisition and the cross-service agreement, which is very necessary among the allies, does not exist between Japan and the United States. If a contingency happens, takes place in the Korean Peninsula, that there has been no rules or no systems established efficiently so far. So in order to prepare for the Russian threat, Japan is sort of well prepared. But otherwise, Japan is not prepared at all. That to prepare for that, that is the beginning, starting point of the deepening of, not very deep at all, but anyhow, the deepening of the security treaty. The crucial point in the development which I'm arguing for is the Japan's constitution. I do not think the revision of constitution very necessary, urgently necessary. But at least we have to change the interpretation of the constitution in some parts. For example, one of the biggest puzzle to me is a government interpretation of the right of collective defense. Every country has an individual and collective right of self-defense. This is the word written in the Charter of the United Nations, one, and also in the San Francisco Peace Treaty, and also in Japan-US Security Treaty in 1960. So we have the right of collective defense, but the interpretation of the government is that we have that right, but we cannot use that. It's a very strange interpretation. A right that cannot be exercised is not a right at all. The right of collective self-defense is the basis of alliance, I think. If your friend is attacked without reason, then I have to come to help him, is the basis of this concept. Without it, a nation has to defend itself by their power alone. That may mean that Japan has to defend itself by Japan's power alone. That means Japan has to become a military power, high-tech military power probably. Just look at North Korea. In North Korea, there is a million of army. In South Korea, 500,000. In Japan, 150,000. Russia, South Korea, North Korea, Taiwan has at least twice more in terms of the number of the soldiers. Just counting out the quality of the jet fighters, in which Japan is rather good. I don't want Japan to be a military power, which is a very dangerous way for Japan itself and for the neighboring countries also. Japan has to remain as a minor military power. In order to remain as a minor military power, we have to strengthen the international cooperation. In order to strengthen the cooperation, we need a right of collective self-defense. That's why I'm very much arguing for the change of interpretation of constitution. With the change of constitution, and we can broaden the activity area of the self-defense force so that we can support the American military activities, which is to contribute the peace and security in East Asia, or that could cover also the Indian Ocean or to the Persian Gulf area. That's the basic point I'm having in my mind. Next point we have to remember about the US-Japan Security Treaty is the Article number 2, Article 2 of the Security Treaty, in which is written both parties, Japan and the United States, should strengthen the free institutions and the principles on which the free institutions are established. In other words, both the United States and Japan has to strengthen its democracies and also make liberalize its market. We have to look back to our history. Though some people say that Japan's politics is somewhat special, or some people may misunderstand that there are Asian type of democracy, which includes China, Malaysia, Singapore, and Japan. No, I don't agree with that. Japan has a long tradition of democratization, which started in early Meiji period. The national level party was first established in 1881. And though it is said that Japan's party politics, Japan's constitution was modeled on Prussian constitution, but actually the Japan's Meiji constitution was much more liberal one than the Prussian, German one. The constitution was established in 1889, and the first parliament was opened in 1890, and within 8 years the political party came to the power, which was not realized in Prussia or Germany at all. After that, in the early part of 20th century, there was a period which is called Taisho democracy. And as Potsdam Declaration said, the post-war democracy was established on the legacy of Taisho democracy. We have a kind of liberal tradition, which was not always successful, but we have some tradition to rely upon. So the Article 2 of US-Japan Security Treaty is not alien to us. That's based on our tradition. The strengthening the principles of democracy, the free market, is part of our obligation and a very good strategy to strengthen our ties with the United States. East Asia has seen a marvelous time for a decade or so. But it's now coming to a very difficult situation with China becoming very big, and Japan is kind of in a stalemate, and the U.S. is, there's some possibility of U.S. withdrawal from Asia. So there are two scenarios conceivable. One very pessimistic scenario is that Japan remains very inactive, which seems to the American people that Japan is very unfair in the area of security. As a result, the security be abrogated, and Japan may face mountains of problems, such as a militaristic North Korea, nationalistic South Korea, resurgent Russia, a nationalist China, none of which is easy to face. As a result, Japan may develop nuclear weapons to cope with these things. A very optimistic scenario may go this way. Japan should begin to cooperate more closely with the United States, including the deepening and widening of the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty based on the new interpretation of Constitution. Now, these efforts, and also Japan deepens the cooperation with the Southeast Asian countries and Australia. The efforts, this kind of efforts, the closer ties between U.S., Japan, Southeast Asian countries and Australia, with Japan's more responsibility. As a result, probably China will take a more moderate, calm, clever foreign policy. That is good, very good to China itself also. So in a sense, the future of China, the future of Asia depends on the course of China, and the course of the United States depends on the future of those two big giants, empires. But Japan has an important, Japan will have an important influence for the future of those two countries. Whether or not the United States can remain firm in East Asia may depend to a certain extent on Japan's foreign policy. Japan has been struggling with the quest of, with the question of East between Japan, between East and Asia, East and West. This was the question the many intellectuals in Meiji period and also Taisho period and Showa period. It has been a central question to which Japanese intellectuals tackled. Now it is again surging as a very important question. The Japan's more responsibility based on a few proposals I just referred to is the question I'd like to provide. This is probably how Japan should answer the very old question of East or West and probably revive the wisdom of the three principles to which I mentioned. I'm sorry, I have passed a little bit. I stop here.
Thank you very much, Professor Kitoka, for that very thought-provoking lecture. I certainly have got plenty of questions, but I'm not going to hog the floor. I think Professor Kitoka has kindly agreed to take some questions, and the organizers of this event have authorized me to run over time a little. So if there are questions, please put up your hands. Announce who you are, unless you are notorious. Over there.
The timing is very important about that. Did you ask that if China really attacks Taiwan, what Japan should do? That's a very difficult question. But actually, the first important thing is to prevent such kind of things from happening, first of all. If between the Taiwan and China, and Taiwan is supported by the United States, then Japan should definitely support the United States. That's my answer. The second, what was the second one? As I told, I'm not a pessimist altogether, so I'm very much having a hope to the younger generation in China. So we have to remain patient. So I do not suggest Taiwan people to make a declaration of independence at this moment. Just wait until the situation changes. It will change. China may change in the future within 5 years or so. So just remain in the very difficult situation. Just remain in this situation. Are you asking how it Are you asking if it is decreasing or increasing?
After the Cold War.
It's in the remaining, relatively in the same, roughly speaking, in the same level. But yes. I'm thinking of a rather interesting thing. We can remember the negotiations with North Korea, with the United States. The Clinton administration is not very good at handling that kind of matter. For example, very important compromise was made very carelessly, or things like that. And actually, the the U.S. bases and the U.S. military forces is not enough to make a full confrontation with the North Korea. So if we think of the possible confrontation with North Korea, it's not sufficient. But on the other hand, it's enough threat to the North Korean government. So what I'd like to suggest is that if we make it smaller significantly, then that may give a wrong sign to China or to North Korea. So that's mainly why I suggest we should remain in the same level.
Ms. Noriko Hama.
The first point, how the rest of Asia are looking to Japan. That's very interesting. And I'd like to introduce those people's viewpoint to Japan very much. I had a very interesting trip to Pakistan last March, and I was struck by the very pro-Japanese sentiment over there. And they were very pro-Japanese and pro-Chinese. According to them, well, majority of their intellectuals do think this way. Why Japan should remain under the influence of the United States? Why not become more independent? Why do not go nuclear armament? And why you should become a nuclear power and unite with China and help us? Is that their viewpoint? I had much difficulty to persuade them that we have much difficulty about that. Anyhow, the distinction between America and Europe and the rest of Asia, the rest of the world, sorry about Africa, has some meaning, because they are the imperialism and the colonies, in a sense, which have the long and rich tradition. So in that sense, there are many needs, demands from those parts, including Western Asia, Middle East, and so forth. But there's a limit of capability. So first of all, we have to make our relations deeper with the East Asian neighbors. And then probably we can extend our approaches to India, Pakistan, and so forth. That's probably possible. With regard to India and Pakistan, there are some characteristics we have in common. We have some traditions in common. For example, British tradition is one of those. For example, the rule of law, parliament, and so forth. And also, when Japan was defeated and Japan began to come back to the world after 1945, it was India and Pakistan, those countries in South Asia, which that extended their hands to Japan. So the having a closer relations isn't very bad. Also, the India is important as a kind of balance against China. So there is another future with those countries. That's one point. And secondly, you were asking about the territorial disputes within China, particularly on Taiwan, or with internal. China is a country which is very difficult to be divided in a stable position. Just compare China and Europe. China and Europe are roughly speaking the same in size. But for centuries, Europe is divided into many major countries like Britain, France, Germany, Spain, Italy. But China has been, in history, has been in a stable political situation under strong rule or divided in chaos. There is no divided stability in China. So that's partly because of the natural conditions. China is a very big country, arable area is rather limited on the coastal area alone. So that reminded me of the fact that another difficult question China may face is a food problem. If the land is transformed into an industrial area, that would cause a big problem to China. And the third one, actually, when I was discussing with the European an ambassador to Japan from Denmark, and I said that it is terribly difficult to make an integration in Asia compared to Europe. Europe is a rather easier case. He just criticized me that it was not easy in Europe at all. But frankly speaking, Europe consists of rather similar. Similar is not a very good word. Asia is very difficult, very diverse. The 1.2 billion country on one hand and very small countries. The political systems are very different. And also market systems are very different. So we can make some parallels between the Britain and the European continent and Japan and continental Asia. But still, the difference is enormous in Asia. The other point we have to pay more attention is the existence of Korea. Korea is a peninsula country. Peninsula, whether peninsula is a continent or an island, it's a difficult question. But actually, Korea has another interesting and difficult history. Korea has a kind of a semi-Middle Kingdom tradition, in which they tend to think that they are again the center of the world. In Korea, political struggle is very, very strong. And everything is involved in Korea, as we see now in the political situation. The punish the former president by making another law is a kind of difficult thing to see. And the burning straw doors of the leaders of other countries is a very difficult thing to see in other countries. In another way, I'd like to say the situation in East Asia, in one sense, depends on the future of Korea very much. At the very beginning of the Kim Yong-san government, there was a future-oriented diplomacy by the foreign minister, Han Sun-ju, who is a friend of mine, which is a very good one, but now they are likely to discard it, which is a pity to me. But if you are more future-oriented, if we make more cooperation, and if Korea can join the cooperation which I was proposing from Japan to Southeast Asia, that will become a very good one.
I would like to add an answer of my own to Ms. Hammer's last question, which was, is it when the British have got problems with the Americans that they become pro-European? And I would answer it by inverting the question. and saying it's when the British become anti-European that they have problems with the Americans. Now it's time for two or three more questions. Wolfgang Papa.
My name is Wolfgang Papa and I'm one of the Europeans. There is a complete guide in what the subject is, what I'm talking about. Nevertheless, I was surprised, even particularly the multilateral framework, which the Europeans are very much aware of and accepting this development. I didn't at all get the word either APEC or the COP, the AEC, something like last year.
Without Caucasian is a very racial idea. So I would oppose if Australia is excluded. But if Australia is included, there's some possibility for Japan to join.
Yeah.
China will probably become an important customer of Japan. Are we talking in terms of business products or business philosophy?
Business philosophy or business customer? As everyone knows, there is a myth of Manchester. if Chinese people buy a handkerchief or a shirt, then that will guarantee eternal prosperity. But anyhow, I'd like to say that the mentality is again also important. When I first visited China in 1988, I have been surprised whenever I visit China by the development of their level of life. When I visited there in 1988 or 87, a friend of mine was saying that they wanted to get air conditioner, telephone, and piano for his daughter. When I visited there in 1919, all three were there. And the goods may change the mentality to some extent. For example, China is, of course, Confucius country. That means authority of the parents and obedient children. But that is likely to go in the near future. Authority of the parents actually depends on the number of children much more than the parents. If you have one child with two parents, then you do not have much authority over them. The capitalism is a very strong vehicle to change the idea. So in a way, both. I'd like to say to your question.
Professor Drifter.
You mentioned or argued that the constitution should not be revised and that it should instead be perfectly interpreted. Don't you think that it's a rather dangerous proposal which would only raise again the suspicion of your ancient neighbors about
Theoretically, I support your proposal very much. And I've been working with Yomiuri Shimbun on this issue. I'm not opposed to the revision of Constitution at all. I'm for the revision of Constitution. But thinking of the few years to come, it would be very difficult. So first of all, let's change this strange interpretation of the Constitution. Because the prohibition of the exercise of right of collective self-defense has nothing to do with the written, the letters of Article 9 or any part of the Constitution. So that change is not particularly a strange one. And also the among the two major conservative parties, Liberal Democratic Parties, and also the Shinshinto, New Frontier Party, there are a certain group emerging and who are beginning to discuss on this issue. So my proposal comes from this political fact and thinking of the a few years to come. But I'm, of course, theoretically it's better to revise it.
I'm going to take the last two questions. One there.
Well, a few, actually two possibilities. Now the Prime Minister Hashimoto is in a sense handicapped by the coalition. The LDP is now with Socialist Party and the Sakigake or Harbinger Party. They are very far in their ideology or policies, original policies. And maintaining the coalition means a lot of constraints to Mr. Hashimoto, who is originally a nationalist. Mr. Ozawa is a very much pro-American, or he's a supporter of the firm relations with the United States, particularly security relations. But I'm wondering why he is proposing, he has not proposed of a change of interpretation as I was suggesting. On the other hand, among Shinshinto members, the minority side, Mr. Hata, is rather sympathetic to my idea. I have not been in touch with him closely, with Mr. Ozawa closely, in the past several months. I do not know. But actually, as a whole, they are more active in that direction, in the more cooperation with the United States. But I feel if the LDP is freed from the coalition with the Socialist Parties, that is also possible under the LDP leadership also.
Last question down here.
This is why I said some word before I started. What I was trying to say is not to defend Japan policy or to criticize the foreign policies of other countries. I just try to understand the direction of foreign policies. My remarks might have sounded somewhat nationalistic, but actually I have not proposed anything of more build-up or tougher diplomacy to China or Korea. The reasons why China and South Korea become nationalistic may differ each other. But my understanding of Korean politics is I have much confidence in the book written by Gregory Henderson, Politics of Vortex, is one I appreciate very much. So, Brover, you know that well already, but please read it again, please.
I must apologize to all the many people who have their hands up who would like to ask more questions, but I'm afraid we must stop at that point, otherwise the drinks upstairs will be getting cold. But before we go upstairs, I would like to thank, on behalf of us all, Professor Kitaoka, very much indeed, for a fascinating lecture, and also for the very open and reflective way in which he has answered the many questions. I think that this has been one of the best lectures which we have had in this series, and a very fitting way to bring the series to an end. Thank you very much.